Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Can you confirm to everyone else that doesn't live in the West Country that when your family opened up a large body shop business, it was called Dick Lovett Spraymaster?
Good name, that. Good name.
Hello and welcome to another Collecting Addicts podcast. I'm told this is episode 11, which is amazing. I never thought we'd get this far. Again, we have some deeply, deeply important issues to discuss this week, beginning with, what's your favourite Ford? I'm going to start off...
Fast Ford, wasn't it?
Well, it could be a fast Ford, but ultimately it's a Ford, isn't it, Edward? Let's not argue about the Blue Oval.
Neil Clifford, what's your cap back on the list then?
What's your favourite? Jesus Christ, he's got it about him today, boys. Watch out. What's your favourite fast forward, Neil Clifford?
The Professionals. I mean, what an amazing TV series. I've gone the Capri 3-litre S.
3-litre S, yeah.
Yeah. Those twin, you know, when you saw a Capri and you'd walk around the back and you'd see the two exhaust pipes.
Yeah, proper one.
You thought, oh, and that. Then you'd look inside and it had the six dials, if I remember, two big ones.
And the four.
Then four little ones around the two big ones. And those amazing seats with the bolsters and the check, the cloth check. That was the car. And I think whichever one in the Professionals,
there was
an RS2000, wasn't there? And then there was the Capri. Yeah. And it had the X-Pack kit. Remember the rare X-Pack body kit that you could get on the Mark II Cortina, Mark II Escort, sorry, the 1800 BDA. And this also had a X-Pack kit. So it would be, without doubt, the Capri 3-litre S.
I think it's a great choice. I'd also love to have been part of the group of people that was allowed to decide what constituted a 3-litre S over a normal Capri. Can you imagine sitting in that room and going, right, we're going to give them... We're going to give them those extra dials there. What should the seat look like? I would have clinicked it by bringing children in and going, right, what excites you most? When you walk past the car and you peer through the window, does that seat look better? Forget about how they felt or whether they gripped you at all.
Neil, do you remember the very, very first episode of The Professionals? Because it had just this amazing plot. I remember it now. They had this amazing plot. Somebody had a gun and it could assassinate someone 1 mile away.
Oh, with the red dot sight.
This assassin.
I do remember the red dot sight. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Unbelievable. And he had to take into account wind velocity. No, you're going to believe this. I think they ended up, it was either on Swap Shop or something. You had Bodie and Doyle talking about a show which stops a guy assassinating someone with all these 8-year-olds. It was
I mean, it's essential training.
01811 8055 was
yeah, we worked that out, didn't we?
Mike Smith.
For the conversation.
Yeah.
Edward, now your family doesn't tend to deal with Fords in the dealership circles, but do you like Fords and do you have a favourite fast Ford?
Well, as I said to you the other day, can I hate Fords like Neil hates Japanese cars?
Neil doesn't hate Japanese cars. He's not in love with them.
He's changed his mind now. I realise that. But, and actually, I dismissed so many Fords when Ford came to my head to start with. But actually, I love Ford because you've got GT40s and Mustangs and things like that. But actually, the one I love the most is not a car. It's an engine.
What's that?
And it's the DFV.
Okay. Okay, you're allowed. You know what?
Technically not a Ford.
Am I allowed that? And
yeah,
and obviously that DFV's got to go in a car. And I've chosen two cars that's going to go in.
Of course you have.
Both, I've raced against both of them. Both whooped past me because I was in a four-cylinder car. one of them was a Matra.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. But the other one is a Ligier JS2, which did Tour Auto. And that I don't think that car should have ever had a DFV engine in it. But go onto YouTube, Google Ligier JS2 with a Matra engine. Or sorry, with the DFV.
Wow, I didn't know there were road cars with that engine in.
There probably wasn't meant to be.
Right,
yeah. And they also put that engine in the Ford Transit vans when they were doing those
super vans.
Yeah.
So I think you couldn't have been more tangential there, but you're allowed all of it, Edward, because it's because we love a DFV. You can't get enough. Just a quick straw poll. Put your hands up if you're DFV or BDA. DFV, BDA,
both.
I can't have. Oh, for God's sake!
Why not? Where's the resources? Right. We can't have both.
Manish, what's your favourite Ford? I bet it's a racing car.
No, it's not a racing car, actually. Probably the first Ford I fell in love with was the Ford Mustang, the GT390 Fastback that Steve McQueen just made famous in probably the most famous, you know, car chase in a film. I mean, we only did Bond last week. But I think that car is just, it's so beautiful. I was doing a little bit of research yesterday and someone was selling one, you know, an American, and they did that kind of classic video and saying, if you look inside, it's got bucket seats. They don't look like bucket seats, they look like seats. But look at the dial. And he lifts the hood and it's just pristine 390. I think it was the S, wasn't it? The fast, whatever the block was, a V8, very, very fast block. And this thing had a four-speed manual because I have been in one.
One floor.
Yeah. And the back of the car, just, the, you know, the... In Mustang, in Bullet, it was the one that had the three lights on each side, but it's a kind of black panel, didn't it? And it just had the Ford logo in the middle, the Bucking Bronco.
They recently sold that car, didn't they? Found it and sold it.
No.
No, they did.
Didn't anyone agree here? Yeah. So if we had a straw poll, I'm afraid to say that the Mustang's never really done it for me because I'm a Charger man. And I just, for me, the Charger in that film is the eye candy, not the Mustang. I just love a Charger. Maybe it's Dukes of Hazzard. I don't know what it is, but I just love a Charger.
The eye candy in that movie is Steve McQueen, really. I know Steve McQueen is the eye candy, even for a man that, you know.
Okay,
fair. Jacqueline Bissett.
Well. He's the eye candy.
Anyone remember Jacqueline Bissett in Bullet? Am I the only one?
Oh, GP's daughter. Are you kidding? How do you forget someone like that?
I know. Well, I don't even can. I don't think
you're quite right.
Yeah. Chris, is the Mustang a car of don't meet your heroes?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, Chris. Yeah. Chris Cooper, tell us your favourite fast Ford.
So I think Ford. I'd go so far as to say I think Ford, for those of us of a certain age, but also younger, I think Ford is possibly the most important brand that's given us enthusiasm for motorsport, for cars, for performance. I mean, it's a cliche to say it's the blue collar performance car or it's democratized it, but it was just everywhere. I can remember, I grew up in Kent and there was a Ford dealer in Ashford in Kent near where I grew up. It was John Wilmot. And I remember just sort of, and they had a book in their dealership before you could Google stuff. And John Wilmot had run Galaxies in British touring car racing in the 60s. This was, you know, mid-70s. And I just thought, they'd done proper stuff. And they had come November, because it was always November, when the RAC rally was on. And they'd had, I don't know whether all four dealers had this, but the one in our town had was, there was a, and I assumed it was a real one because I was about 10. And I assumed it must be real. There was that red Cossack sponsored Mark II RS 1800. Roger Clark's car in the showroom. And I just thought this was impossibly exciting. I mean, I had little tingly things all over before I knew that things could tingle. And in the next town up, Maidstone in Kent, there was Haynes of Maidstone. I think it's still there. They were even more impressive because they were a Ford RS dealer. So that meant they could sell road cars and I think probably the homologated rally cars. And I remember one day driving past, seeing in the window, probably a Mexico, Mark II Mexico, and a Mark II RS-1800. Only one I'd ever seen as a road car. It was a, you could buy it as a road car, RS-1800.
Beautiful.
And everyone was excited by it. So I'd probably say it's probably the RS-1800 Mark II. And there's a bit of symmetry here because my boys are now 20 and they're totally into, how did that happen? They're totally into cars and they love cars and racing. When I asked my boys, I asked Cameron last night, what's your favourite fast Ford? And he said, it's a Mark II Ford Escort, but with a Millington engine in it, that sort of 2.3, 2.5, 300 horsepower. And I thought, the dream is still alive. There's sort of that image of Ford. Okay, they're not called Ford Escorts now. MST make them, and they're called a Mark II, aren't they? So I think we all owe Ford a huge debt of gratitude. And I'm sort of quite glad to see that they're still playing with motorsport in Formula One in a few years' time with Red Bull. But yeah, it would have to be RS-1800 that I saw in the window of Hayes and Maidstone, late 70s.
Well, at least we've got a Mark II in there. We had to have a Mark II in there. Sensational car. Yeah. You're not looking to work for Ford anytime soon, are you? It felt like a call to action that did, Chris. Are they looking to be a client?
Well, you know, sort of many may be called, but few will answer. And I could answer that one, yeah.
I wonder whether you've got the blue oval on your pants this morning. Anyway, it's lovely to hear that.
Funny you should say it. No, I won't show you.
That little political message. So here we go. Mark II's on my list, obviously. I've got one as a rally car. And there's something about seeing a photo of it on the lock stops, on gravel, doing its thing. I'm not sure that there is a... I'm not sure if I was running Ford that there could be an image that I'd be more proud of. But I'm not sure it's relevant to the company anymore. I echo Chris's thoughts that Ford obviously was created to make money. The old man himself was all about making money. But I think we have to respect the fact that they ploughed so much of that profit back into entertaining us.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to do that. They probably didn't sell many more cars on the back of it either. But they had it in their blood. And I think that needs to be respected. I've got some weird ones. I drove a Mondeo 2-litre that was the one that was launched in 2000, I think, or 2001. Yeah. I drove it from John O'Groats to Land's End and back again. And it was a pre-prod car and I had to do a story for someone. You know when you bond with a very ordinary car because you live in it? It just struck me that we were so lucky that under that Richard Parry Jones era,
he recently
passed away.
Very sad.
What he did do is, to use that word that Chris used, he democratized great dynamics. Because in the past, the dynamics of an expensive car were unique to those. And Mercedes had independent rear suspension and it had years spent on the way its tyres worked with its springs and its dampers. And Parry Jones said, there's no need for that just to be an expensive car. Let's have it on cheap cars. So you'd suddenly get into a Ford Focus. Well, it was the Mondeo of 93 actually that changed everything.
It was.
Suddenly there was this Mondeo that had fully independent suspension. It was just amazing chassis.
Lovely
the way that
drive.
It rode and steered. And he carried that on. And the next Fiesta was the same. So I think we owe them that. But there's a couple of cars that stand out for me. I've got this thing about the Raptor in America. Whenever I'm in America, I love driving a Raptor because I think that reminds me that Ford has a very different image over there. Yeah. Over here, Ford is the car of the people. Over there, Ford is just America. And I respect that. And I do love, I shouldn't love them, but I love a Raptor. But there's one car that stands out for me. The first generation Focus RS was something that I reckon I've done 50, 60,000 miles in these things.
Yeah.
There's opinion split on them, but go and look at a picture of one now. There's no car that sits on the road better.
It's got stance.
They are ferociously fast in the right hands. And the story behind it, which is story for another day, means the car should never have existed. It was a total folly. They lost money on every single one. And that's another subject for conversation, which is, are cars even greater if they're built in the knowledge they're going to lose money?
Yeah.
And I think that there's something about that that I love. So for me, long-winded, first generation Focus.
Good correct.
Nice.
Now, international road trip roads. And I'll tell you why it's international, because I'm slightly against sharing UK roads, because I think they should remain between us. We shouldn't give that information out, because otherwise people go to those roads and they cause grief for the people that live there. I'm a bit funny like that. So, Neil Clifford, where would you go if you took your passport and you had a car?
Well, my biggest memory is the A1, and that's not the A1 from Highgate to Edinburgh or wherever the R1 goes.
Goes to Edinburgh, yeah.
Yeah, it's the A1 that goes from Melbourne to Cairns. And I drove this road. It's 4,000 miles. And it took 4 months. And I was in a Volkswagen camper. And it was 1993. And I did it with my now wife. And I had the most amazing experience, the biggest memories of my life, that single road. What a beautiful country Australia is, to be honest. Sydney, Brisbane, the Gold Coast, Cairns, Townsville. I learned to sail. I learned to dive. I lost my hair. I lost my wisdom teeth. I learned to cook for 3 months in a camper van. I discovered, what did I discover? VB beer, Tim Tam biscuits. I learned how to catch a those fucking spiders, what were they called? Those hideous spiders. Huntsman, the huntsman spider.
Oh, they're that big.
This thing is about this big. And they crawl into a camper van when you've got your, you know, you've got your little tent up and you're sleeping in the back and these fucking things just hang there and you've got to catch them with a big sort of pint glass and chuck them out the window. So for me, I've got many, you know, lovely European roads in a 964 RS and all that sort of stuff. But frankly, the A1 from Melbourne to Cairns would be my chosen road. And we should all move to Australia. What a bloody magnificent country that Australia is. That would be my choice.
Great choice. I have to say, I agree on all fronts, apart from one thing. Since you were there, Australia's become rather anti-speed.
Yeah.
And it's a very difficult place now to enjoy in a car unless you're kicking back in a camper van. If you've got anything with any power at all. And also, they have speed camera technology that means that if there's a cop car coming towards you, somehow they can catch you. They can work out your speed in that direction oncoming, which I still believe is a lie.
My camper was called Eric, and I don't think we ever went faster than about 53 miles an hour, even downhill. Yeah. So I was probably safe from the
Would you repatriate Eric to the UK, or do you think Eric?
Oh, I'd adore to find him. You know, pulling up in one of those sort of middle and because we drove then actually from Cairns to Alice Springs down to Darwin and back up to down to Adelaide, then back up to Darwin, and you pull into one of those pubs in the middle of nowhere, and you discover the glass in the freezer for the beer. And everyone's drinking beer basically on the road. So there's no sort of drama on that. There's no police anywhere. There's just those huge lorries that overtake you. But yeah, I was there a year. What a magnificent country and lovely people.
I'm going to go Manish. Let's hear where would you go?
So this was a trip that I did actually in October 2011, we went from New Delhi, the Imperial Hotel in New Delhi, to the Oberoi Hotel in Agra to go and see the Taj Mahal. And this is actually a pretty well sort of known sort of beaten track. It's the I-19, and it's there are two ways of doing it. The I-19 was the way that our driver took us. And you will never go on a more terrifying 2.5 hour trip in a car anywhere else. Basically, there is no driver that you can hire who won't be more than 1 foot behind the car in front of him at every speed. You've talked about undertaking. There is undertaking. There is overtaking. There are camels in the slow lane with bushels of wheat or whatever that are nine times wider than the camel. The best thing we saw was in the slow lane, an auto rickshaw coming the wrong way. And the reason why he was coming the wrong way was because he wasn't going to wait till the next off-ramp to come back round because he'd missed his off-ramp. And it was an unbelievably terrifying journey. But the absolute best bit was about 20 minutes before you actually get to the Taj Mahal. You pass a place called Fatehpur Sikri, which was the Mughal capital of India in the 16th century. So all the traffic slows down there. And I was sitting there. My son was five. My wife's on the other side. My sister's in the back with us. And there was a little boy with a cobra. You know, there are people selling you stuff.
You mean the snake, not the beer?
Yeah, with a cobra, a real cobra.
You mean not the car, Chris? This isn't a herpetologist podcast.
Yeah.
No, but so my sister just points out this cobra to my son, who had a little obsession with snakes, and just winds the window down. So this snake is 4 inches away from my son's face. She goes, "Don't worry, it won't bite." How can she know? How can she know that? No. So you come up
to the secret. Been on that road, Manish, in a bus.
It is absolutely nuts. Terrifying. And then the most amazing thing is you pull around past Fatehpur Sikri and you see the Taj Mahal for the first time as a family. I mean, I actually grew up till I was five in Agra. So it wasn't a great big surprise for me. We used to go for picnics almost when I was a kid. But for my wife and son, it was just the most magnificent end to a journey. You see,
the plan was that he was going to build an opposite one on the other side in black.
Yes, exactly.
A black one. There was supposed to be two.
So Shah Jahan was incredibly in love with his wife, Nur Jahan. Mm. Incredibly in love with her. And she died very early, giving birth to, I think, something like their 12th child. I mean, he demonstrated his love. And he built the Taj Mahal. And his plan was to build its mirror opposite on the other side of the river in black. But his own son imprisoned him. And what he was allowed to do, and I think it was in Agra Fort, from where you can see the Taj Mahal. So what he would do is he had his bed moved such that when he woke up in the morning, with clever placement of a mirror, he could see the Taj Mahal every day and think of Noor. Do we feel like that about our wives?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
No.
Moving on.
That's a lovely story. It also it reminds me of the fact that this isn't just about roads are about much more than just going fast. You know, yeah. I think people expected us to talk about there I was on the door handles. No one said that yet. However, that might change. Ed would love it.
Oh, all right. Can you give me 10 minutes? I'll come back to you with some romantic story.
Pick one.
No, I am going to pick one. And so for quite a long time whilst I was at Dick Lovett, I started arranging road tours. So I got out the maps of France and Italy and got my highlighter and sketched all the different B roads around France and Italy. And driving through predominantly France, it's almost impossible in the middle of France to find a bad road. But there's one particular road, and fine, you can drive quickly on there if you want, but you don't have to because it's empty, it's beautiful. And it's the D996 that goes from near Troyes or Troyes down to Dijon. Easy to remember because of the name. I was actually in a 997 at the time.
You should have been in a 996, really.
Yeah,
I should have been in a 996. But that road, if you're ever driving south through France, go drive it. It's incredible. And then I hope someone's going to mention Switzerland, because again, this doesn't have to be through speed, but you know, spending a day going over the multiple passes in Switzerland is about as magical as a driving experience can be, whether you're on your own or with someone, but going up and down just the most beautiful scenery. It's a privilege that everyone should try and find the opportunity to do.
That's true.
I'm going to go next because I normally end up bringing up the rear on these and I fear that people don't like me as an aftertaste. So I'm going to go next. I've been pretty lucky. I think I've driven on most of the continents and filmed some crazy things. And I'd love to tell you that it's Kazakhstan or it's Ethiopia or it's Australia or some weird part of America. But I come back to France again. I'll tell you why. There's a bit of speed involved. The cliche road that actually lives up to all expectations is the Route Napoleon. It's not overstressed. It's a truly great piece of road that sort of forges north of Grasse. And it's easy to not spot it. It's not very well signposted. But once you get onto the right road and you follow it pretty much up to Grenoble, it's just some wonderful stretches. And it really is a great test of a motor car dynamically. If a car works there, it'll work pretty much anywhere. The Stelvio, all these other things, they're totally overrated. Go to the Stelvio for an afternoon and it's like being told to go to the finest restaurant and then giving you some slop. It's just pointless. I don't really see it. It's a nice photograph to have in the album, but otherwise, avoid. But actually, if you go up the Route Napoleon and you get a bit inquisitive, there's some roads that pop off it that are really quite special. And there's one called the D21, which sort of fires left from the Route Napoleon. You're going north, just fire left, and it heads down towards a place called Draguignan. And for all sorts of reasons, it's special for me. It's one of the first roads in that area that I probably tanked on a bit. And we did lots of photographs down there back in the day for autocar road tests. And it always, always worked. And I have one of my favourite memories, which is a photographer called Kenny P, who is a legend of the sort of performance car era and also fast bikes era. This is a man who, to get stills of a motorcycle going around the Nürburgring, sat facing the wrong way on a bike in front of the other bike to film it. He was that level of madman. Anyhow, we were there for the Mark II Focus RS launch. I'd nicked a car from the launch to go there and photograph it. Kenny P was in the bushes, and he had a fantastic, slightly northern accent. Kenny, if you're watching this, I love you dearly. Anyhow, he could squeak when surprised, and I saw him run from a bush in a way I'd not seen him before, pursued by two large adult wild boar. And it was one of my favourite things, watching this tough northerner being properly chased by two prehistoric-looking
piggies. Cartoon doors.
And he had a good turn of speed, did Ken, but he didn't get the tracking shot, which was a problem. Sorry, it's a panning shot. He didn't get it, but I saw him being, these fucking pigs were large, and he really had to get out of the way. So I love that road. But I think what everyone else has already spoken about is that there's something romantic about the road ahead. The road ahead is a metaphor for so many things in our lives. It could be that the road ahead is our future. It could be that we're wistful for a different future. You look in the rearview mirror, of course, you've got the opposite. You've got your past. There's something about a man laying something quite obnoxious, asphalt, onto open ground that romanticizes our lives in ways that I find quite difficult to interpret, because it makes you think probably too hard about your life. It isn't just about getting somewhere from A to B. It represents more than that.
Best ideas are driving a car.
Chris Cooper,
destination.
What's your
destination? Yeah, so you kind of where you finished off is where I started, really. It's a destination. Draguignan, there's that really nice restaurant in Draguignan, Bruno's, if anyone knows it. Yeah. You have to like truffle, slightly tedious if you don't, but it's a wonderful, if you're in the south of France on holiday, Draguignan, Bruno's, it's a great destination. I've been thinking about this one quite a lot. What makes a great road trip? And you can have some great road trips work by yourself. You can be in the car by yourself. You can be singing to music, you can do whatever. And you can be going Harry Flatters. But I remember when most of you know this, and some people who listen to you will know this. I first met T'other Chris when we raced together in 2002. And we had the first time we really got to know each other was our first road trip. And we drove in a Mitsubishi Evo 7.
We did.
From the then auto car offices in Teddington, somewhere down there, through Eurotunnel, all the way to the ring, spent a day pounding around. We were training for the 2002 24-hour race in the Caterham. And we spent a day training there all the way around, and we drove back. And it was just great fun. I didn't know Chris at all. But we just got on really well. And it was just such a great trip. And it was, the destination was, I mean, we've done loads of trips since where we've driven across through Eurotunnel. And you come off the train at Eurotunnel, and wherever you're going, east across Europe or south, you just know it's going to be a great trip. And that sense of adventure when the train doors open and you go up over the ramp.
Oh, it's brilliant. Where that's lovely.
Most of Monkey's oversteer shots have been taken on that off-ramp coming out of Eurotunnel. We tried it once in a Jaguar XJ and we forgot to take the traction control off and it didn't work. And we looked a bit
but sick. I did get it right with the boss of Mercedes PR in an SLS once, probably a bit too right. And I was so committed, I had to overtake a family in a Vauxhall Zafira as they were coming off the train. And not everyone was pleased.
Yeah, but I think that if I was to pick a road, and it kind of shows that you don't have to have an extraordinary car. So there's a road on Mallorca. Cyclists will know this because Mallorca is great for cycling. It's the road that goes from right at the tip of Formentor to Puerto Valencia. It's the MA2210. And I was there a few years ago with Lynn on holiday, my wife, and we had a Renault Megane convertible. It's a bit old, a bit knackered. Not a great car, but on that road with the seat, the cambers, the scenery, the smell in the air, the open top, it was one of the most lovely drives I've ever had. And it just, so road trips are about destinations. And I think the company you've got, they don't have to be great roads, but if you want a great road, the MA2210 on that right at the tippy bit of Formentor in Mallorca gets my vote.
Anyone that has suggestions, please stick them in comments because that's the kind of stuff overseas that we like to share. Yeah. Now, moving on to another very important subject. This could be a long podcast. This is the best looking exhaust, and I'm saying outlets, tips. We're not talking about manifolds. You can probably go into manifolds if you want because I suspect Manish might get a bit motorsporty here, so you can talk about white powder-coated spaghetti Ferraris if you want. But I'm just guessing there, Manish. But I think it's outlets, not intakes, and it's not noise. Exhaust noise for me is so easily contorted by taking cats out and putting fancy exhausts on. So, Neil Clifford, what's your favourite looking exhaust tips?
Well, in crikey, my career has peaked. Clearly, one could easily go Ferrari. One can, and I'm sure maybe some of you guys have done. Could easily go Lamborghini. You know those four pot ANSA exhausts hanging below the arse of a 275. But you know, in Portsmouth in the 70s, there were no Ferraris. There were no Lamborghinis. You had to go to Chichester to see a Porsche. But what there was Jaguars.
Yeah.
And when I was walking around and walking to school and daydreaming along when I should have been studying, in fact, if I was 15 now, I would be that guy stood on the corner of Mount Street with a camera, with an Instagram page. You know, you had top trumps, as we know, in the 70s, not cameras. But it was the discovery of a E-type Jaguar V12.
Oh, yeah.
2+2 automatic. So in many regards, the shittiest.
Not E-type, a great E-type.
But
the exhaust. Those
fucking four exhausts. Oh, yeah. And this car was in, I think it was called Heather. It was the pink. It was owned by a woman in Torrington Road, which was three streets up from my house.
Do you know what number was she at?
Number 49.
Okay.
It was in, I think it's called Heather, and it had a cerise, so it's basically pink and pink,
yeah.
E-type, a 2+2 automatic, but that badge, remember the badge, which is a fucking massive V with a little 12 written inside.
Yeah, nice badge.
And these four big exhausts stuck coming out underneath the car. For me, that will always be peak exhaust pipe.
So actually, interesting point. The best exhaust on perhaps the worst looking car ever made. Strange.
Yeah.
I jumped straight onto Classic and whatever it's called. Obviously, you should look at collecting cars. But I looked at another website and there's one there, a fucking pink one with a full basso roof, automatic. It's like 40 grand. I'm like, oh my God. It's almost worth it for the exhaust.
No, it's 40 grand too much for that shit. Yeah, yeah. Chris Cooper, what are you going to have?
No. That's not an exhaust.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
We can't that's... see that. What's...
That is an exhaust.
Is that what's that on?
Matra MS-11. Matra Ooh. V12. To my Matra's mind, well, the exhausts have got two jobs. They've got to make the car super fast, super loud, and they've just got to look like that's an exhaust. Sex. And that Matra MS-12 looks like an exhaust. Inconel. You know what Inconel is? Inconel yes. is a nickel super alloy, which is particularly resistant to the oxidization that steel would go through when it goes through extreme heat cycles. Engineers and scientists in the audience will tell me where I got this wrong. But my recollection, because I used to know a guy who ran an Inconel-based exhaust building company in motorsport. And Inconel is, so Pagani Zonda are exhausts. Just take the back off of Pagani Zonda. It's just Inconel goodness. So
is that the white stuff?
It can be sort of non-shiny. Yeah, can be painted, I think. But Pagani Zonda are for now. But Matra, I mean, that's an exhaust. End of. I think it's fantastic.
Manish, I think he might have stolen your thunder there.
He hasn't. You did, but he did quite. Veto me. I thought the whole point about this, we just slightly bend the rules. We're basically all really clever accountants, aren't we? Always constantly finding that way around Mr. Taxman. But it's a little story here. In 2009, we went to interview Sir Frank Williams to have a chat with him about Senna, to see if we get some lines about him. And unfortunately, he couldn't do the interview. And we were shown around Grove, so we made the journey up by one of their comms people, and we went into the engine shop, and he did exactly. So at that time, Williams had a 2.4-litre GFW31, had a 2.4-litre Toyota engine, a V8, and they showed me the handmade exhaust manifold for this Toyota. It was the RV809, and they explained that even with Williams' giant technology, you know, even with all their know-how from sort of at that point 40 years of motor racing, there was no one who could actually machine one of these. These were hand-built. And I held one of these things. It was the most beautiful thing I think I've ever held. And you could look at the one from the left bank and the right bank, and you could just see the very subtle differences in these that some bloke has quietly fashioned so they can bolt an exhaust onto the back. And for me, that was it was an epiphany. It was an absolute, the idea that you've got these carbon fiber cars and this engine comes over from Japan and you've got this amazing seat fitting and you can automate this, that, and the other. But in the end, when you need to stick an exhaust onto this engine, a bloke has to do it.
Yeah, Beautiful. It is. Yeah.
It just made me so happy. Yeah.
Somebody will tell us in the sort of messages who, because I think there is one specialist business, certainly a leading one, maybe a couple now in the UK, that fabricates that stuff. It's extraordinary. It's real artisan stuff.
Edward, what are you going to go for?
Well, you're not being very fair to our key sponsor, Porsche Cars AG, here, are you? Well, I was doing my research, and there's some very ugly exhausts out there, aren't there? I was also going to try and find some silly ones that have just got exhaust covers where you can, if you look in the pictures, you can see the actual outlet and then the cover in the bumper. But the Cigaris is quite a weird-looking thing, isn't it, with the two exhausts coming out the side at the back. But You talked about the Mark One Focus RS earlier on, where you look at it and it just has that stance.
Yeah.
And whenever I see a 70s Porsche with cookie cutter exhausts on it from the back three quarters, I need to get in that car and start it and drive it, because they always sound exactly as I want a hot Porsche from the 70s to sound. So a cookie cutter exhaust is my choice.
I think I can't disagree with that. Now, this is a subject that I've vacillated so much on over the years. I posted on our WhatsApp group a picture of the 365 GT4 BB, which is the only Ferrari that ever had six exhaust outlets. Yeah. We'll put a picture of it now. It's actually too absurd. I don't think it's aesthetically very appealing. Yeah. But I do think it just shows you how far the theatre of exhaust went, even in the 70s. And I think we have to acknowledge the fact that the art of exhaust outlets has been subjugated recently. Car makers have made them fake. They have they have disrespected the art of the pipe, and they shouldn't have done that. It's a great shame. And I've gone through a few, and with Neil, the idea of a sort of a junk, I'd call it a junk of answer hanging underneath the back of a Ferrari. I mean, it's just so, you know, anatomical, isn't it? It just looks like a pair of nutsacks hanging. And I love that. And I love the fact that, for me, a French Renault 5 Turbo with a devil exhaust, almost with like a trumpet, with an expanding diameter, a great thing. But when it comes to OEM exhaust, there's one company that, for me, has always had it lit. And I just love the way they look. And they are honest. They're not trying to do anything more than they are. But what they did do is they absolutely demonstrated why that vehicle was more important than the car on which it was based. And that's BMW M. I think they've always just had it right. And the first time, for some reason, this still works for me now. The first time I saw an E39 M5's exhaust pipes in that subtly redesigned rear valance, I just thought, that will not be bettered. They had nailed, they were just the right size. They weren't ostentatious. They were just the right size. There were four of them. They were proper pipes. They were meaningful. They had to be there. They're just, go and look at one now. It's fucking perfection, boys. I can get passionate about this. Yeah. It's perfection.
The E60 M5 is very close. It's very close. Because you look at it and you think, no, it's quite close. It's not like...
It could be that close. It's still a mile off. The E39 M5 is peak. Look at the gaps between them. Look at the way that they're presented. Look at the way they protrude. They're just... I mean, I have to stop myself getting behind these cars.
Yes. I don't think anyone would care about that.
They're amazing. So, we're going to get onto another geeky one now. God, we could do these forever.
Fast car names.
Fast car names or numbers. I'll tee this up, because Manish is going to go first. So Manish, get ready on the blocks here. I'm interested, first of all, in why numbers can sound as fast as very fast-sounding words. That's another quirk of our language and of the way that we communicate with each other. But I want to know, what are the fastest-sounding car names? Why does Pagani sound faster than Camry? I don't know. Tell me. Manish, tell me.
Lamborghini Countach LP 5000 S4 Valvoli.
We're going to have to practice this stuff, because only you can do that.
Well, how can a car sound faster than that?
I've just got to get some tissues. Hold on.
Yeah.
It's true. It's absolutely true. It's just something 5000S in Italian. Quattro valvoli at the end of that. How can something sound so fast? I could bring up my old psychology notes, because I did a big module on Noam Chomsky and the acquisition of language, but there is just something about numbers, isn't there? Numbers are just so sexy. They are just so sexy. And adding that extra zero for no good reason at all just made, you know, the car, 50 miles an hour faster, didn't it? Just did.
Oh, God, I think we've peaked there. Chris Cooper, come on.
No, I mean, some obvious ones, really, aren't there? Thunderbird. Ooh. Firebird. I mean, how fast do they sound? Valkyrie. I mean, that's just going to be an animal, isn't it? I mean, we know it's fast because we've seen it, but if somebody said, I'm going to call it Valkyrie. So it got me, I've cheated a bit here. I've gone a bit off-piste. And I couldn't help myself. I looked at then fast racing drivers' names.
Oh, come on. Don't give me Lorenzo Bandini.
No. Scott. We know Scott Speed, Will Power, Nick Swift, Chris Cooper. Those are all super fast racing drivers. Fireball Roberts. There's a NASCAR driver called Fireball Roberts.
Lightning McQueen.
Dick Passwater. Dick Trickle. We know Dick Trickle. Dick Seaman. I mean, how could Dick Seaman be a racing driver now? I mean,
hold on a minute. You're sitting with the grandson of Dick Lovett. Be careful. It's
Dick Seaman.
Edward, can I stop there for 1 minute and ask you one question? Is it true? Can you confirm to everyone else that doesn't live in the West Country that when your family opened up a large body shop business, it was called Dick Lovett Spraymaster?
Good name, that. Good name.
Chris Cooper, somehow you've got us on to talking about male ejaculate when we want to talk about fucking fast car names. Get back on track, son, or you get a detention.
Swim Savage.
I prefer the racing Savage. Driver name.
I mean, it's like Doc Savage, isn't it? I think if you had to go for the fastest car name, I think the Americans, Ford Thunderbird.
Okay.
I mean, just, you know, the Beach Boys, all that stuff. It's brilliant. That's what I go for.
Neil Clifford, bring us back, please. Oh,
I've got a couple, if you bear with me. For me, it was often about the longest possible badge. So if you go, and I'm doing a bit of a Ford reference here. When you saw that Granada Gear IX. The fucking length of that, it must be such an impressive
nothing without
thing.
The X.
Yeah. You had to have that X.
You did. Yeah.
Gear IX Granada.
Yeah.
But I think so I was always impressed with that. But the best car name for me is the Jensen Interceptor.
Oh, yeah. It's my boy said that. Cameron said that last night.
It's the best car name.
Yeah.
It's the unbeatable. The Interceptor. I mean, whatever happened to Jensen, I'm sure it's being bought out for the 17th time and some guy's going to bring a new Jensen. But it's the best car name.
There we go. Yeah, Edward Lovett, I don't know what you're in good fooling today. Just keep this sensible. Go.
I will. To be honest with you, I was struggling here. Neil, I went a bit your direction trying to think of... And Mercedes are the worst culprit of this over the last 10 years of... How many letters and numbers can you get on the rear boot lid of a Mercedes? I think it's like something like an E300 compressor Blue Tech or something like that.
24 valve.
But the names for me are Bentley's, Speed 6, Speed 8. Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so for me, it's numbers over words. That's the bit that I can't. I can't understand why. I think it refers back to our youth. Neil's just touched on it there. The stuff that captivated you when you were a kid. And I think part of it was thinking, I'm enough of a geek. I've seen from the front of the car what I think it is. And that walk round to the back to have it confirmed by a boot badge. And I was obsessed with BMW. So for me, the idea of seeing a 320, thinking, oh, if I go around the back, has it got two exhaust pipes? Is it a 323i?
Yeah.
And that also made me realise there's something about symmetry. Why does 323i, the repeat of the 323, why does that sound faster than 320? I don't know. The I makes all the difference as well. Someone get inside my head and explain this. Why does 250 GTO on paper look like it's doing 170 miles an hour, but to me, 275 doesn't look as fast? 275 is quick, but 250 is faster. I don't know why.
But surely, isn't it as simple as we know what a 250 GTO is? And we know...
I think there's certain Ferraris that if I just saw their name on paper and didn't know what they looked like when I was reading in Car Magazine, I just knew they were fast.
The 500 super fast.
2.7 RS just looked fast. Why does 2.7 faster than 2.2? I don't know. It's not because it's bigger capacity. But I found these things captivating. I really did. And you can give me any number of Pagani... Huayras or
that is a Caterham's the R5. I think the R500 K Caterham has always sounded better than the R600 or 620. R500. It's a round number. It's 500. What else do you need to know?
I think that car was a mythical car because it was the fastest 0 to 60, wasn't it? That R500 K series.
But yeah. The BMW one, Chris, as it was in, obviously as a BMW fan, you know, when they started going off into 218s and things like that, it would just totally lost it. Where's a 330? Well, actually, 330 was quite a movement away from the 328s that we loved.
But at least ones, they and twos, them, you know? Ones and twos sound slow, don't they? If you have a BMW 1 something, three, a BMW 2 something.
Yeah. I know. But a 145i, that doesn't sound too slow.
No.
Or, I know, sorry, 135i.
The 535.
They became meaningless as well. A 323i was, you know, about the swept capacity. I can remember the first time it got me was when a 323i had a 2.5-litre engine suddenly. That was in about 1998.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to the BMW press office, and I felt like driving around there and hurling excrement at them because I just couldn't believe they'd broken the sacrament. He shouldn't be allowed. Anyway, no, for me, because this is sponsored by BMW M today for me, it's the M5. There's something about the combination of the letter M and the number 5 that just gets me going. And it's impossibly fast.
It's better than M3.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I'm going M5. Yeah. Now, we are going to, at this point, insert a little bit of F1. There's not much F1 chat this week. McLaren made some changes. And Manisha said, we know it's a slow news day when we want to discuss Valtteri Bottas's moulet, which I'm not that interested in because he seems to be getting a lot of currency out of it on Instagram. But I will say this. Daniel Ricciardo actually has scored the same amount of points as both of his new McLaren replacements. I'll give him that one. But he seems to be reduced to the role of, sort of social media monkey. I'm not sure I like it. I think there's a certain amount of schadenfreude for some people, but all we get is him doing pranks. I think he's better than that, isn't he?
Yeah, I think it's a bit... I'm a bit worried about it. In all seriousness, I'm a bit worried about him, Danny. It's just, he's a bit lost. And I think getting him to do these silly clownish things is a bit... not very dignified.
Isn't he just enjoying his $15 million?
I mean, he could be. He could be. And maybe that's compensation. But, I mean, he's never going to come back, is he? He's never going to come back. There's just, you know, it's a conveyor belt. And we just know that, although this year's F2 crowd doesn't look like it's got very, very strong. A whole bunch of people have been in it for 3 or 4 years. So I think this year's F2 won't scare the horses. But Piastri's clearly been quite pretty good. I mean, Danny Ric, I don't.
Do you think he should go to NASCAR and go and join Kimi and Jensen? Do you think that would be good use of his time?
Well, it's surprising he's not, because he's the one that's probably the best known in the US. Isn't it strange that no one's offered him a drive? It must be that they've not offered him enough money.
No, they've offered it to him. He's turned it down.
Yeah.
I think he's too busy just having a laugh.
Maybe it is, as we see, he's actually really happy, but he looked really not happy last year. So, you know, we wish him well. We really do. But
When you finished racing at the top level and you had some time the next year, how did you deal with it?
I just...
for those listening...
Chris, how about you?
Oh, I never reached the top. I never reached those heights, Edward. Tell us something else about F1 in the next 5 minutes that's interesting and that's thought-provoking.
Well, there was something I read yesterday. Stefano Domenicali was said to have said that he wanted to get rid of free practice over the weekend. And there were lots of ways of looking at it. The quote's supposed to be, it's good for engineers, but not good for the fans. And you do feel this constant wind of, We've got to sell this, you know. We've got to make Formula One even more exciting and sexy than it is. And I must admit, Autosport actually dissected his words a little bit. And they came to a slightly different conclusion, which was, it's not a question of reducing the amount of track time over the weekend, but it's in some way a bit like the sprint races, finding some way of making free practice competitive so the audience will enjoy it more. So maybe giving points for free practice. I mean, I don't know what you'd give points for, but my slight concern is this, that you know, cars don't test anymore. They just don't test. They've just moved all of that money into computer modeling and virtual testing and putting drivers into sims. So you can't go to Silverstone and watch a test, which you could back in the day. And it was great. It cost you nothing. And you literally, you could get autographs if you wanted to. You know,
brilliant.
People hung around for 8 hours, you know, probably two in a car. And I guess it's very important for the engineers to have this test time because that's the time they hone the cars. But obviously, Stefan is a very smart guy. He knows this. And the point is this, that if they got rid of it or reduced it or made it less meaningful, it quote unquote increases the unpredictability of the race, comma, therefore mixing up the grids. And at some point, this is starting to look a bit like a contrived, you know, add a bit of DRS, add the cost cap to it. You're starting to feel the formula, I think, in all kinds of ways you probably shouldn't.
I agree. Isn't it strange that when Federer is knocking up at Wimbledon on one of the practice courts, he's left to knock up. They're not trying to monetize that or make a stunt out of it. Every other sport allows its competitors to some time to warm up and get their shit done. And I just don't see why Formula One can't do that. If they're going down that route, they might as well keep them warming up and then just throw water sprinklers on for 10 minutes of every race. If they want randomness, there's a better way to do it, isn't it? Sorry, Chris, I was talking over you then. What are you going to say?
No, I was going to say, I think there's a couple of things where, and we've talked about the complexity and the impact of the cost cap. Really good mate of mine who's just retired from 20 years at Red Bull. Before that, John. Before that, he was lead designer at Reynard when they were, those of you who remember Reynard, designed their Champ car, their F3000 car, F3 car. He then spent 20 years at Reynard, Red Bull, retired last year. And he said, I saw him at the end of the year, and he said, by the end of the year, well, last year, he said, for the first time, I didn't really understand all the rule. I couldn't see it. I've always been able to see the rule and think about what the car is and how it works. But now, it's too much. It's too complicated. I don't understand it. And for an awful lot of engineers, that has taken the edge off it. And it takes the edge off everywhere else because it's too complicated, too messy. And I think there is something about simplifying the rule. Lots of people now, more people are talking, particularly with the EU exemption this week on
change. Yeah. Yeah.
On they can now sell cars after 2035. In theory, which will only run on synthetic fuels. Not quite sure we're going to force that. Come back to that. So I think there is hopefully an opportunity to say, let's simplify the powertrain, have louder engines, simplify. And I think the idea about using monetizing the free practice is part of a just stop fiddling. Actually, it's working. And young people get it. So, yeah, I think I'm with you guys on this one.
Well, we do have a race this weekend, don't we?
We do have a race this weekend.
It's your favourite country in the world.
It is. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, to bookend what I just said there, imagine you're Daniel Ricciardo, you've gone back to your home Grand Prix and you are basically a performing chimp. You know, you're there, they Red Bull, they've got a stick and they're going, right, go over there, do that.
I mean, they're getting him back for giving Max quite a hard time in the early part of his career. Somebody's sitting there going, okay, here's the next trick. Daniel's going to wear a fez, some flippers and a snorkel, and he's just going to walk down the pit lane with a beautiful girl with Red Bull on her dress.
I reckon they've got three pots on with different words on a desk somewhere in the energy station. They just pull them out, and one says penguin, one says flippers. You're quite right. And what can we make him do now? But I think there's some of it is deserved. But I think it's gone too far. Let's just say I find it uncomfortable viewing now. I wish him the best, and I hope he can get back to some racing soon. Now, we're going to move on to our two-car garage today, set by Manish Pandey, a man who has a wistful addiction to a decade that began with a six. So, my fellow contestants, you are Peter Sellers. It's 1968. You've just had a massive hit with a film called The Party. You're a global superstar, as big in LA as you are in London. You have two homes in both. No, you don't. You have homes in both, one each, sorry. Create a two-car garage for either. The world is your oyster in 1968. So it's two cars. One's to be kept in LA, one's to be kept in London. It's 1968. Edward Lovett.
God, he had great taste, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, we don't even need to go and choose cars he wished he could have had, because he had them all. Which ones would I have out of the ones he had? Well, in the UK, given the weather I'm currently looking outside to, which is meant to be spring, he is going to have his original 275 GTB 4 cam in Azzurro Metallizzato, recently restored, was red, now back to its original colour, and found a new home, I think, recently. So that's my car for London. And then in the US, I think it's got to be a Daytona Spider. Those are my two cars. Fine. I'll send it back to Autocraft, where they chop the tops off the original coupes and turn it into a Spider. Yeah, that did happen.
Okay.
He had a beautiful Maserati Mistral Spider as well, but I wanted two Ferraris in my garage.
Chris Cooper, I hope you're going to obey the years for this, because Edward's just blown it out of the water there. So don't suddenly think you can move to 74 or something, because you can't.
So I don't know that he ever had one of those.
Ooh, yes.
Oh, yes.
33.
We all know what that is, Alpha 33. Sorry. It had a 2-litre V8 engine that revs to 8,500, 6-speed manual gearbox, 968. So I think, I mean, Manny, only you can really comment on this. I mean, it's an interesting character, Peter Sellers. The party, he played, did he play an Indian doctor or an Indian
something
else? He wasn't
an Indian doctor. In the party, he plays the most accident-prone Indian actor. He blows up
and
the
it
set.
Was, it was and a he's millionaire.
He's put onto a do not invite him to anything list. Unfortunately, that means he gets invited to a party.
Yeah.
And his name, it's got the best name, Harandi V. Bakshi.
Yeah. He was in two films where he basically played rather caricatured Indian characters. The Millionaires with Sophia Loren.
Don't forget his radio. To interrupt Chris, his radio. If you go back and listen to his radio stuff, his Indian voice is the most common one. He's using it the whole time.
I watched the party with my very Indian mother, my very Indian sister, and our Indian cousins. And my mother wouldn't accept that he wasn't Indian. When the dog comes to try to eat his shoe, right? He says in Hindi, "Go away, go away," and the word is "jao." He goes "jao, jao," like that. My mother said, "He's Indian." And I said, "He's really not Indian." She said, "No, he's
quite
Indian.
Not Indian."
You've heard the way he said "jao." He's Indian. And he does say, he says, "In India, feet are considered a delicacy by some animals." Okay.
So that's the people. So if we put that slight sensitivity aside, I think an Alpha 33 Stradale is just, and they're about 10 million now.
Which country are you having
that? And the other one I'd have would be, because I have a connection to him. So a friend of mine now, or somebody I know, now owns the beautiful house he used to own in Chipfield in Hertfordshire, a couple of years before this, but we'll skate over that. And I can see the garage in this beautiful house, Chipfield Manor. And I think it would have in it, or outside it, a DB6 Vantage shooting brake.
Beautiful.
Which I think if Type 33 and a DB6 Vantage shooting brake.
So I the think 33 lives in America?
No, they both live in the UK. Yeah, I'm Peter Sellers, I've just defined it.
The question was quite simple. You've got to have one for his home in LA and one for his home in the UK.
He'd take the bus in LA.
I'll tell you what, it's like herding cats with you lot. I'm going to have words with you after this. It's just this.
Where is rules coming from? We didn't used to have rules.
Okay. And by the way, the DB6, you can just about go for the shooting brake, but DB6s are wrong. They're too big and too heavy. You know that. Neil Clifford.
Right, LA, you'd have 300SL Roadster.
Okay.
Ooh.
Alloy body, alloy bloody engine, disc brakes, Rudge wheels, factory hardtop, the whole fucking works. Oh. The one of 29, whatever. So, that's the car for LA. What would I have in the UK? You know, I was tempted to say what Ed did, really, which is 275, But UK, screaming around London in the 60s, an E-Type. I'd have an E-Type. I'd have an early 3.8 open bonnet lock thing, flat floor. Yeah, the lovely little sports seats in navy blue, red leather. It's equal to a 275 in truth, but about a tenth of the price.
Okay, I can't argue with those in a way that I can argue with a DB6. Right.
Well, you say that. I think he was attracted to the latest thing, which is why he had four wives.
I think you're right. I think that's a fair point. I think you are acknowledging the personality of the individual, but I still think DB6 is not the answer to any good question.
It would Mantis have been a better airport card than the 330 IX.
Oh, yep.
Just get,
yeah,
Edward, get over it. Get over it.
Right.
So two things on Peter Sellers. Sorry, Chris. One, he was from Portsmouth.
Was he?
Yeah. He was born in Portsmouth, yeah.
Born in Southby in Portsmouth. And yeah. Two, if you do anything after watching this podcast, watch the interview with him and Parkinson.
Yes.
It's the most beautiful piece of, because the guy was a lunatic, bless him.
He was, and
probably not, I think Chris mentioned, he's not that nice a character in truth, but a total comedy, utter genius. Yeah. Up there with the best. And
Tony Hancock, the
Parkinson on YouTube, where he literally just talks for an hour. Parkinson's
if you,
going,
if, and if you go, if you, no, if you by the way, you know, the thing comedy. About
him, he wasn't just a comedy genius, he was an acting genius. So he had done Lolita. Oh, yeah. He had done Lolita with Kubrick. And when he played Quilty in that, he was as good as anyone. And he did Dr. Strangelove. If you look at that, he played three parts. And not every single line is fine. I know Dr. Strangelove himself is very funny, but you know, Kubrick wanted him to play Major Kong, the B-52 pilot as well. And he pretended he had a broken arm because he just could not face that.
Beautiful.
Couldn't face that. Amazing. Unbelievable.
If you want to investigate his radio comedy, there's loads of CDs out there. It's not a very good online resource, but the radio comedy that gives you the voices that refers back to what Manish was saying. He played with these voices, but his ability to conjure names as well. There's one where he plays a retired actor who's fallen on hard times, who goes into to collect his dry cleaning. I think it's his dry cleaning, and he's forgotten it, but he's a drunkard, and his name is Warrington Minge. he's just utter genius, and he rolls the R's. Warrington Minge is his name. Anyhow, so I think. The only quirk I want to apply in my imaginary Peter Sellers world is that he'd want to when he's in LA, he'll want to display his Britishness. When he's in the UK, he'll want to be more international. Let's say. And I think so. For me, in the UK, it is 68. Edward's stolen my thunder. He likes the latest thing. To refer back to Chris Cooper as well. He's bought a Daytona. The car's just been launched.
Good call.
The problem is the Daytona is going to be short lived because he's stuck in town with a truck with no power steering. So I suspect that gets sold quite quickly, and he ends up with a 50 grand worth of wooden picket Mini, because that was his thing. He was known for driving around town in very expensive coach-built Minis, wasn't he? That was his thing.
Yeah.
So I'll say Daytona. And I think in America, there's a car that I think he owned that is one of my absolute favourites. If I had all the money in the world, I'd have one of these. It's a 1953 R-Type Continental Bentley.
The big,
it's the most beautiful car they've ever made, undoubtedly. We'll put a picture up now. They made one in a colour which is typically called maroon. And I'll see if I can find the photo for it. Just sensational car. You could buy it with a manual gearbox. It would cruise at 120 miles an hour. And for me, that is... I could see him cadding around Mulholland Drive in one of those, depositing his latest conquest at their house. He's...
If I couldn't get a DBS shooting bra, I'd get one of those, yeah.
Okay.
I could see you in Clifton in one of those, Chris.
Google the Alan Clark car. He had one for years.
Yeah.
In a light
need to do
green.
Alan Clark.
So green with green.
Well, actually, he had a couple, didn't he?
And
I think the idea, but I want the one with the spats. It is one of the great shapes.
Did you go upstairs in Swindon and see PFLs?
I did, yeah. And it was sensational. I thought he was going to keep it.
I think it's there, isn't it?
It's there.
It's been 5 years being restored.
It's black, that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stunning. Okay, so we're moving on to...
I get to do Peter Sellers?
Oh, shit. Sorry, man. Carry on. I apologize. We're not for so long. Carry on.
So, weirdly, I had a very similar vibe to you, Mr. Harris. I thought in America he'd want to be very English, and I thought in England he'd want to be very continental. So in England, I gave him the Lamborghini Mura P400. It had just come out.
That's quite good.
For it.
I forgot about that.
I still think it's the most beautiful car ever built. Every time I see one, which isn't very often, I just slightly lose everything. It's just unbelievably low, unbelievably curvy. And I think the P400 had the eyelashes, didn't it?
Yeah.
The original one. So it's just such a beautiful, beautiful car. And in America, and I just did think that of all the cars he had, the one I could see him cruising down Mulholland Drive with was the 65 Bentley S3 Continental. And he had two, not one. And it's the one that ends the back of it. It's got sort of fins, almost like the American cars with the three vertical lights. And didn't they call them Chinese eyes or
Chinese
something? Chinese lights.
Chinese eyes.
So he had the it's just such a great car. It's just basically a straight line from the side. And I could see him with the roof down in his silver version of that with the black leather, with his, you know, sunglasses on. And his, you know, Britt Eklund said that he would leave notes to his cars in the cars.
No.
Right to his cars. That's why he should really be on this show.
He should be.
He would literally.
Neil, you need to feel less guilty about doing that now. There was someone else.
Yeah.
No, but the thing is,
that even more now.
It's really funny because we all love dogs as well, and I think she reasoned it as it's an act of love from him, and this thing cannot argue back. It just loves him back. You know, he buys a beautiful car.
That's really good.
Beautiful car just loves him back. So he just left notes. They found all these notes, and it's, can you imagine, right? Dear Mura, I love you so much. I look at you in the morning, and I want to melt. I want to make you a coffee.
Dear Miura, I'm unsure of your polar moment of inertia during long right-handers.
Now, I'm not sure I could do it out loud, but I might be the right thing. Literally.
I love that story.
Right. Thank you, Manish, for another pearl there. So a bit of music. Manish, you might as well continue that one. Come, where are we going with Muzak today?
Okay, so we're going to go for the song from the film The Party. It's a really funny moment that everybody's ignoring him or being mean to him. And this very beautiful French starlet who's there to make a great impression on General Clutterbuck, who owns the studio head. General Clutterbuck, he's got this great line. He goes, "Who's the foreigner, a general?" like that when they first see him. He goes, "Some weirdo my wife invited." So everyone's mean to him, but this lovely, lovely French woman, starlet, is the only one who talks to him very, very nicely. And she said, "Do you speak French at all?" And he goes, "I know one thing in French." And he says, "Où est la direction de Tour Eiffel, s'il vous plaît?" That's all he says to her. So in the middle of this film, she starts singing the song. And it's actually written by Henry Mancini, lyrics by Don Black. And it's called Nothing to Lose. And she plays it on her guitar. And he needs a wee really badly. So you have the most romantic song ever. And an Indian who needs a toilet. It's perfect. And you've got to hear this in a car.
Okay. Edward, on to you.
Speeding car going 90 in the rain. Tory Lanez, The Colour Violet. I stumbled across it today whilst hunting down some automotive related tracks.
Okay. You heard it first. I'm writing these down because I'm about to go on a drive. So I want to put these into my title in a minute. Neil Clifford.
I'll WhatsApp you a link.
In my little Volkswagen Combi with my now fabulous bloody wife, we had three CDs to last us 4 months. One was Out of Time REM, one was Stone Temple Pilots, and then there was The Counting Crows.
Oh,
yeah. That was called August and Everything. And it's a wonderful album, as always, I say.
Brilliant.
Download the old bloody album. And even though I was going to choose the first song, I'm going to choose Perfect Blue Buildings on that album. It's wonderful.
Counting Crows.
Brilliant song.
Yeah.
So I've got two suggestions before I get to my music. And the suggestions link the fast-sounding car names with Ford, with Peter Sellers. Two more racing drivers. These are real things. Stingray Rob. And if Peter Sellers had played an Englishman trying to be a NASCAR driver, he would have been, and I'm not making this up, Duck Waddle.
I like that.
The tune is Florence and the Machine, You've Got the Love.
Just before you do that, can I ask one question? Because that is a remarkable piece of behaviour there. So when you were at school, when you went from maths to English and you were in a different room, a different block of the school, and someone said, "So how do you feel about King Lear's relationship with Ophelia?" Did you say, Pythagoras.
I would have. I actually did that. I actually did in a French language lab. I actually recited one of the episodes of The Muppets when the Swedish chef would just put somebody into an answer. And funnily enough, nobody saw the funny side of it.
There is a psychiatric term for it. It's called a perseveration error.
Yeah, whatever.
Do you remember the Two Ronnie sketch where they did answering the question before?
Oh, yeah, that's too complicated. I need to be a bit more creative, but yeah.
You've got the love. Chris, give us your music.
Florence and the Machine, You've Got the Love. I think it's a wonderful,
lovely track. Lovely.
Right, I'm going to go for a tune that everyone will think of me trying to be a bit too young, but it's a band from 20 years ago, Jurassic 5. I think they're absolutely brilliant. Mm. And there's a tune that has got a bass line, and it's called A Day at the Races. If you listen to it, be careful. It makes you want to drive really, really fast. So lovely. I'll sign this up by saying, listen to A Day at the Races, but just keep those testicles cold. And that is a lovely way to wrap up what's been a most enjoyable episode 11 of the Collecting Addicts podcast. Please leave some comments. It's more pleasant if they're positive comments. Get involved. And we've got our Spotify playlist. How many people on that now, Edward?
2,000 people. And we have used a different format to record this today. So if there's any issues with video quality, we are trying to improve where possible.
I'd like to say thank you to my fellow addicts, Neil Clifford, Chris Cooper, Edward Lovett, and the great Manish Pandey. And we'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.